Thanks for choosing us, The Takeaway, for your listening pleasure. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is today's show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Later this hour on this Earth Day, we'll have some compelling thoughts about what the Earth gives us and what it doesn't give us. But we begin with this. Okay, Senator McConnell, we didn't mean to rush you.
I said from the beginning to the end that we'd take up the Attorney General nominee just as soon as we finished trafficking.
That's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking to reporters about delaying a vote on the nomination of Loretta Lynch to be Attorney General, a delay that has reached some moderately historic proportions. Finished trafficking, Majority Leader McConnell says, which is a bit of a term of art, referring to a bill to fight human trafficking in the U.S., even as the human trafficking crisis in the Middle East continues to hold the world's attention. No, it is unlikely that we are in any sense finished with human trafficking, but this cliffhanger is over for the human trafficking bill in the Senate and for the nomination of Loretta Lynch as Attorney General. The compromise on the trafficking bill, which was all about an abortion provision, came Tuesday afternoon. With me now for more from the Capitol is Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Hi, Todd.
Hi, John.
So Lynch will be confirmed. We do know that. I didn't really mention that, but we think she's going to be confirmed, right?
Looks like she will, especially under the nuclear option rules instituted by Harry Reid when he was majority leader. She faces a cloture vote tomorrow, but remember, she's not a Supreme Court nominee, so 50 votes, not 60. She's likely to get through.
And explain the compromise and how it finally came to a head or to a sort of a quiet end here.
Oh, yes. Well, this goes back more than 4 weeks. And you got to cast your mind back to when the human trafficking bill got on the floor just over a month ago. It was headed for easy victory because pretty much everybody supports it. It has lots of provisions to increase law enforcement, to set up compensation funds for victims. Everybody was on board. It was going to be a bipartisan win. Until some groups in Washington, some pro-abortion groups, pro-choice groups, noticed that there was a provision in that bill, a small provision tucked in there that made reference to another bill that expanded the Hyde Amendment. And if you don't remember what the Hyde Amendment does, it's been in the law for more than 30 years. The Hyde Amendment says no federal funds can be used to pay for an abortion. What does that mean here? That means here that any victim of human trafficking or sex trafficking who qualifies under this bill, who got pregnant, couldn't use her compensation fund money to pay for an abortion. That was a big problem for Democrats because the compensation fund money that's set up in this bill doesn't come from taxpayers. It comes from fines, a $5,000 fine that's brand new under the bill. And that's what lit up this whole controversy. It's relatively narrow in terms of policy, John, but as we've said, abortion politics in Washington is like the West Bank in Israel. You don't move the line a centimeter or it's a war. And that's what happened. So finally, after Mitch McConnell, as you heard at the top, tied the Loretta Lynch nomination to this bill, what that meant was senators weren't going to let the human trafficking bill die because a lot of them want a new attorney general. Republicans want Eric Holder out of there. Democrats love Loretta Lynch, and they want her confirmed. So everybody was motivated. And here's the compromise they finally reached. That compensation fund is now split into two parts. The part that comes from fines on perpetrators says you can't spend any of the money on any health care at all, abortions or anything else. The other part of the compensation money that you can spend on health care that comes from taxpayers, that's already subject to the Hyde Amendment that's already in the law, which means in the end, no federal money at all for abortions. The compensation fund still stands. The wording is jumbled around. And if you look at it the right way, I suppose everybody wins, although that's questionable, too, since this took a month.
And the logic of denying people health care money if they're victims of sex slavery, I don't know. There's a logic there that I don't see. We can explore that in a minute with somebody who looks at this much more closely. But this is an example where bipartisanship, the fact that everyone was motivated and the Loretta Lynch nomination really work to get this bill tweaked in ways that may come back to haunt us. Listen to the sort of hurry up, let's go of Dick Durbin talking about this bill.
It's time to move Loretta Lynch. We need to do it before we go home this week. We owe it to this country. We owe it to Loretta Lynch. And we owe it to the Senate to get back on track and approving qualified nominees.
Is the hurry up mentality here something that caused the legislation in the end to be modified, tweaked? There were capitulations that we're going to hear about later.
It's hard to call it hurry up, John, because it took more than a month.
Right.
And so
yeah, exactly.
did it finally push people to make an agreement rather than just drop the bill and move on to something else? Probably. And therein you see some of the artistry of Mitch McConnell's leadership there, tying these two things together. Did it frustrate a lot of people that Loretta Lynch's nomination had to wait until a deal on human trafficking? Sure, it did. It frustrated Eric Holder too, because he's still in the job and he wants to get out of it. The White House didn't really seem to be all that concerned about it. They weren't lobbying Capitol Hill hard to get a deal here, but it did bring people to the table and said, you can't drop this bill because the majority leader won't let you. Now, Loretta Lynch has spent longer on the executive calendar, sort of the wait list for a vote, longer than the previous six or seven attorney generals combined. It was a long time. President Obama named her some 165 days ago, so it was a long wait for her, and looks like she's finally going to get her vote tomorrow, John.
Well, the Lynch issue is important, and also the administration has made human trafficking a real signature issue, but we'll see what the legacy is going to be. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much, as always.
You got it, John.
This compromise we just spoke about with Todd, where so much of the debate was about the Hyde Amendment abortion test, may not be the only compromise in this bill intended to combat the growing problem of human trafficking, an atrocity made much more globally visible by the migrant deaths in the Mediterranean Sea this year. Human trafficking, where desperate populations end up essentially in conditions of slavery, in many cases, sex slavery. These victims were to have been the main focus of this legislation, but are they? Joining us is Kate DiAdamo, a national policy advocate for the Sex Workers Project of the Urban Justice Center. Kate, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So are the victims really the focus in this act as you look closely?
You know, I would say not. And it's one thing to talk about it as a compromise, but really this bill, from its inception, has moved the focus away from the needs of actual victims of trafficking and really to the needs of law enforcement, and prioritizes them, in my opinion. You know, even when we talk about things like the Domestic Victims Fund, which is established in the bill, it really does support the expansion of law enforcement. And when you look at the other mechanisms in the bill, it's about expanding the powers of law enforcement and expanding the crimes that they're looking into, which don't have anything to do with forced fraud or coercion.
So let me just split the hair here a little bit. When you say it advantages law enforcement, a person who's not familiar with the details in this bill might say, well, of course, we want police fighting this kind of crime. You're saying the expansion for law enforcement doesn't have anything specifically to do with human trafficking in this bill?
I'm saying that taking a purely law enforcement and criminal justice approach to trafficking is really the wrong approach, and especially if we're going to talk about justice for victims of trafficking. What we need to be doing is expanding the direly needed resources for marginalized communities, for those vulnerable to trafficking, for those in trafficking situations, and for those escaping trafficking situations, and this bill does not prioritize that.
What do you think the designate for Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, is going to think about this bill ultimately, because she's at the center of the whole legislative battle over it?
Sure. You know, the Attorney General has a mandate that is very specific, and I think it's an important one. You know, I think it's important to talk about victim services and, you know, the organizations who work with victims of trafficking. We work with law enforcement all the time, and working in partnership and in successful collaboration is absolutely a central part of a lot of our work. And confirming the Attorney General is, I think, a step in the right direction for that. But, you know, are we talking about how to better prosecute traffickers, or are we talking about serving the needs of victims and ultimately trying to stem trafficking? Because that's not what's centered in the bill, and that's not where the conversation is. And I think prioritizing this as a way to combat trafficking is really about decentering the conversation onto, you know, what happens after the trauma has already taken place, as opposed to how do we prevent this crime? How do we stop this crime? How do we stop the expansion of this crime? And this bill is an unsuccessful way to do that.
Does anyone deal with preventive measures at this point? Are there any programs that exist already for high-risk populations?
Absolutely. And actually, it's kind of funny that you bring that up. You know, when this bill was moved out of the judiciary, one bill was left behind, and that's the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act. And that bill, all it does is fund services for some of the most vulnerable populations. And so as much conversation, as much debate as this bill is getting, what is left behind are things like the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act.
Why do you think lawmakers capitulated on these issues that wouldn't appear to be as controversial as the Hyde Amendment?
You know, it's definitely challenging. I think one of the problems is that, you know, when was the last time you saw an article about trafficking that didn't talk about arrests and prosecutions first and foremost? When we talk about how we're combating trafficking, the numbers that we always take are not how many people are less likely to be trafficked this year. The conversation isn't how long are, you know, victims supported after they escape trafficking situations. The conversations are always about arrests. The conversations are always about prosecution. And so when you see a bill that comes up that says we're going to raise the number of prosecutions of traffickers, that's where the conversation is right now. And that's really unfortunate.
So the cultural shift to focus on victims is not really in this bill, and it remains for the future, a future battle both on Capitol Hill and among policymakers.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I constantly am asking people to do is not to say, you know, is this a bipartisan bill? Is it not? If a bill about victims of trafficking, if the best thing we can say about it is that it's bipartisan, we're not doing our job.
Kate DiAdamo is a national policy advocate for the Sex Workers Project of the Urban Justice Center. She spoke with us from Washington, D.C. Kate, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Later this hour, the human narrative of seeking treasure from underground or under the oceans, a narrative that's as old as civilization. Reporter Tom Burgess recounts a macho tradition among some South American copper miners.
I went with some friends, climbed up this mountain, and the main miner started to explain the history of the place. It emerged that it was my 23rd birthday, and the miner looked at me and said, you know, actually, we have a thing we do here. We have a tradition where we do push-ups for every year of our life so far when it's our birthday. I said, yeah, absolutely. I'm more than happy to do some press-ups. You know what? I'll do it on my knuckles. It's no problem.
I think make it a little interesting.
Yeah, a couple of friends I was maybe trying to impress, and there were a group of pretty burly miners, and I thought, yeah, I can match that. And the miner had got a slight twinkle in his eye and said, okay, then come aside, and we'll do these press-ups. There's one thing I forgot to mention, though. When we do the press-ups, we do them with a lit stick of dynamite on our back. But then there was no turning back, so I said, yeah. Great, okay then, off we go. Down in the press-up position, lit his dynamite stick, put it on my back. I did the 23 best press-ups that any human being has ever done. Then he took the stick off my back, lobbed it into a hole and exploded. Dusted myself down and off we went down the mine. And as you go deeper and deeper, you hear the stories of how many people have been crushed or asphyxiated. You hear the incredible risk that's taken for a minuscule reward, really. And so I was kind of grateful to that miner who nearly purified me on the mountainside, because it just gave me a sense of the cheapness of life next to the greatest stocks of mineral wealth.
More from the insane Tom Burgess, a reporter, and how his interest in mining led him to tell the story of the looting of Africa's great mineral wealth. We're asking you, what first world luxury do you loot, do you take, do you feel guilty about? From Dallas, Texas, fountain drinks and the big giant wasteful styrofoam cups they come in. They come from oil, of course. Join the conversation at 8778MyTake or tweet us at The Takeaway. More of that conversation later this hour. This is a year of reflection for people whose lives changed with the fall of South Vietnam in 1975. It split the family of 13-year-old Pascal Phuong Dong, who escaped with her mother while her father and her two older siblings remained behind. They were eventually reunited because of Pascal Phuong Dong's father's determination to be free, a fantastic tale of escape, more than worthy of StoryCorps.
My father never shared this story with us, but this was my brother who shared this story. My father went underground and he turned himself to a fisherman. He left Saigon and he went to a fishing village near the sea, and he let his beard grow long, and by himself he built a boat out of plywood, whatever he could get his hand on. He got some engine and take years, you know, you cannot do it overnight.
Yes.
Years just to gather the material. My brother told us that the boat just have like a little bunker underneath. That's where everybody, 420 some odd people, they all sat like sardine. Mm-hmm. Just no room to lay down. There were three boats left that night. And my dad was the first boat that went out. And they turned on the radio to listen to the weather. And they said the biggest hurricane of the century on the Pacific at that time. And my dad said, it doesn't matter, hurricane or not. He went right into the international waterway. The other two boats, when they heard that the hurricane's coming, they just went along the edge of Vietnam, and they got caught. So my dad went right into the biggest hurricane of the century at that time, Hurricane David. And he was the only man who sat the whole time at the wheel and tried to hang on to this little boat, you know, 100 mile an hour knots of rain and wind. And my brother said the waves were so high that you don't see the breaking point. All you saw is a wall of black water coming toward you, in front of you, and this little boat, like a toy, this little boat just climbed up this mountaintop, like 30-story building, to plunge down. And then again, the next wall of black water.
Wow.
And on the fifth day, from far, far away, my dad saw some sort of light, and he knew that's a big ship. So he gave order to try to burn everything they could and make SOS signal. And suddenly, they signaled back to acknowledge. Mm. So everybody was just like, oh, God, finally somebody signaled back. And it's a Russian flag. Mm. And then to get on the Russian boat, that means to go back to Vietnam. They will give you back to the Vietnamese. And that's the end of my family. But the people on the boat rather get on this ship with the Russian than be alive and then deal with whatever later than die at sea. But my father stood up and he said, our family will die at sea, or we will make it to freedom. But we're not going to get on this ship. Mm-hmm. And any of you who want to get on, please, you know, I will try to get as close as I can, and you get on, but we are not. Everybody decide to make it or die at sea with him. So one day, we receive a letter who said that they made it to an island in Malaysia.
Wow.
And I remember in Lubbock, Texas, you know, they came and we were so excited. The first thing my dad told my mom was that I have done my job. I have reunited the family and brought us all together. And my job to you as a husband and father, I have accomplished my mission to you. That's the first thing he told my mom. And I thought about it. I thought, thanks to him, to his bravery and his conviction, that 400-some people, family, now multiply and have a chance to have a great, better life with dignity and freedom. And they spread out all over the world. And thanks to that.
First Day's Story Project is a collaboration of PBS's American Experience, WGBH, and StoryCorps, and was inspired by the documentary Last Days in Vietnam. Listen to more stories at pbs.org/firstdays.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. TIAA-CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Iran is a nation in constant conflict with the United States. Whether it is in nuclear negotiations reaching a decision point this year, or in the Persian Gulf where U.S. ships are watching for signs Iran is seeking to aid rebels in Yemen with weapon shipments, being linked to the U.S. and Iran can be considered a crime. This week, a Washington Post reporter based in Tehran was officially charged with espionage after being in detention for 9 months. So what must it be like for a European to fall in love with an Iranian and get their paycheck from the great Satan, the USA, for the past 13 years?
It was so different for me to be here. And I think, yeah, I could have married a girl from the Dutch countryside. It would maybe would have been different and maybe in many ways it would have been easier. But I'm happy I chose you.
Of course you should be.
Thomas Erdbrink is Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, speaking there with his Iranian wife, Nusha, a photographer and artist who he met and married while covering protests in 2002. Thomas is sharing his unique perspective on life inside the Islamic Republic of Iran in some short documentaries for The Times. His most recent, An Eye for an Eye, is about a woman who rejected a man who then blinded her with acid. After a long court battle, she was allowed to blind one of his eyes. Thomas Erdbrink says the literal eye for an eye approach of Islamic law in Iran is rare to appear on video.
Filming in Iran is very complicated. You need a permit from the Ministry of Islamic Guidance and Culture, and they generally don't like to have foreign TV crews to spend too much time in the country. So we didn't have any time to research. I just had to draw from my older articles for the New York Times. So many of the characters that you see and many of the subjects that you see, for instance, the fact that women were not allowed to participate or in the viewing of volleyball matches because it would be un-Islamic, that's a story I did. And now I've brought it to life using different characters people who I interviewed, I should say.
And in this An Eye for an Eye installment, you're really talking about, you know, an example of Iran as far away from modernity as you can get, but also struggling with it, even in this seemingly barbaric story. Describe how you use this story as an example of just how Iran is caught in the middle.
Well, the Eye for an Eye story is first and foremost a story about Islamic law, and Islamic law is at the basis of the Islamic Republic. But at the same time, it's also a story about normal people and how the law works for them or against them. And in this case, a young woman, Amaneh, was thrown acid in her face. And under Islamic law, under this eye for an eye law, she was allowed to get retribution. She had to fight for years because the Islamic courts didn't accept her to be of the same value as a man. And what she demanded was actually quite bizarre for us. She demanded that her attacker would experience the same what had happened to her, namely that he would have had acid dropped in his face, in his eyes to be specific. So this all sounds very barbaric. At the same time, Amina is a young modern woman, basically a representative of those statistics I just spoke about, and she was struggling all throughout the process if she wanted to take revenge or give forgiveness. And, well, I don't want to give it away, but when the video airs, you'll be able to see what she ultimately decided. But it's very surprising, her decision. And it's also surprising that this Islamic law, under which hundreds of people are hanged every year, also offers this opportunity for the victim to directly forgive the perpetrator.
Thomas Erdbrink, in some ways, we see in this documentary, and it happens to be the case, that you've really thrown your lot in with Iranian society. You're a part of it more than a reporter who just parachutes in. How does that change or improve your insight into Iran as a journalist for The New York Times?
Well, that's, of course, a very, very valid point. And one could also say, have I gone too local? I do think that because Iran is such a close society and such an isolated country, it's not your average posting. It is not a country where you can come in and rotate for 4 years and then move on to another country. You need to learn the language. You need to develop your contacts. It all takes a long time. At the same time, Iran is a very dynamic country. Our reporting, look at what we discussed on the show. We would talk about Ahmadinejad and his denial of the Holocaust. And now we're talking about the nuclear case and a possible compromise in relations with the United States. So I always hope that the quick developments keep me fresh. And I, of course, very much depend on my editors at the New York Times to keep me in line and to keep me informed of what a Western audience finds interesting.
Is one of your editors, your wife, around the dinner table arguing about some of these issues that are real life issues for you and your family?
I think in every healthy marriage, a husband will also console with his wife. You know, the news doesn't allow itself to be channeled in by either the wishes of my wife or the Iranian authorities or sometimes even my editors. We should try and write it the way it is. And sometimes it's a positive story, but very often it's a very negative story coming out of Iran.
If we're to agree that what's really going to be happening in the next 5 years is some kind of emergence of Iran, what are the first things people are going to see about Iran that you notice every day as your experience as being Tehran's bureau chief, that in some sense these documentaries are trying to help us understand?
Well, I think they will see that for many, many, many years, the image of Iran has been dominated by Iran's hardliners, the fist-pumping, bearded people, black women in chadors that we have seen in the news basically day after day, year after year. At the same time, we will see that a very significant development has taken place in Iranian society. People have been modernizing much quicker, at a much quicker rate than many people in other countries in the region. And the statistics actually show that very well. Iran is a country where 70% of the people live in cities, so they're urban. 70% of the people is also under 35 years old. 60% of all university students are female. So these are all statistics that don't exist in many of the regional countries. And they are statistics that show that Iranian society, as the videos also show, is much more complex, forward-thinking, if you will, than many other countries around.
Thomas Erdbrink is Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, and you can watch his documentary series, Our Man in Tehran, at thenewyorktimes.com.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And Moo, working to help businesses stand out with a range of business cards and printed products for telling a company's unique story. Also offering Printfinity, the ability to print a different image on every card. Learn more at Moo.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
What if your nation's flag was less recognizable than the minerals exported from your lands? In fact, what if the place where you lived basically had no flag?
Again and again in Eastern Congo, in the diamond fields in Zimbabwe, in this kind of oil-fueled, rule-by-fear society that has developed in Angola, places like Guinea, again and again and again, I would see this juxtaposition of deep human poverty, and often suffering, and often violence, next to the world's richest repositories of bauxite, of diamonds, of copper, of oil, of natural gas. And it's not a coincidence. The one causes the other.
The relationship between resources and human suffering is the subject of Thomas Burgess's new book, The Looting Machine: Warlords, Oligarchs, Corporations, Smugglers, and the Theft of Africa's Wealth. Burgess says economic growth due to demand for natural resources mostly conceals how resource economies, like those operating in many nations in Africa, actually hold their citizens in extreme poverty.
There's been this narrative of Africa rising, which is pretty nonsensical in two ways. Both of the words in it don't make a lot of sense. The idea of Africa as one homogenous blob and the notion of rising. I think certainly that there are pockets of Africa where there's great entrepreneurial explosions, someone like Lagos, a lot more business being done. And in parts of coastal Africa, for sure, the last few years have seen a kind of commodity boom and what have you. But by and large, there are still massive human problems in Africa. I'll give you one example. Angola was growing at double digits for a decade. I think one year it was the fastest growing country in the world. But a much more revealing statistic for me is if you take those growth numbers, GDP per head, girls' education, gender measures, these things that really affect how people's lives are lived, and you subtract one from the other and you get another table, and that will show you that Angola and other resource producers in Africa, several of them are clustered at the very, very bottom of this. And that shows you that they are doing the worst at turning booming macroeconomic growth into improved living standards. And the suggestion, I think, is that that just demonstrates that little elites at the top are creaming off the vast majority of that benefit.
And what the bottom looks like is shown in some other statistics that you write about, and that is that in many of these resource-rich African countries, you have huge percentages of the population living below the $1.25 extreme poverty number for incomes. And that just seems just unsustainable on every level.
Well, it's just something that I think we don't think about. We think of Africa as being very poor, and vast numbers of people in Africa are, as you say, very poor. But there's also immense natural wealth. There's like $350 billion roughly goes out of Africa every year in exports of oil and minerals. You take somewhere like the DRC, Congo, enormous country the size of Western Europe, and the guys who are close to the president, there's one Israeli tycoon in particular, Dan Gertler, have made fortunes trading in the rights to copper mines. But there, that figure for the number of people who live under $1.25 is about 88%.
Oh, my God.
And the state doesn't really exist. Everybody is just out, as I try to argue in the book, it's a kind of a roadblock economy. Everyone wants to seize a piece of land and extract some rent from it, whether that be the presidency capturing the copper rights to a checkpoint in a militarized area in the east. It becomes, at every level, a rent economy, which is the poisonous thing that happens when your economy is completely dependent on the export of minerals.
You know, one of the things that you say in this book that I think takes it to a different level, there have been many social scientists and development folks who have reminded us that among the places in the world where there is no nation, where there are millions of people living without any governance at all, Africa is among those places that has the most people in that circumstance. You make the point that the rent economy that you describe in these places of riches, whether we're talking about Central African Republic or Congo or Angola, don't require governance to function. That many innovatively have just said, forget what the UN is saying. We're just going to ditch the government altogether and take our wealth and let the people sort of survive as they need. We'll have enough weapons around here to keep it from getting completely out of control, but we're happy with this situation, and go to Congo and that's all you have to see.
We being the top level.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that this term I kept coming across was the kind of shadow state, more in Congo, in Nigeria, in Zimbabwe especially. People would say, people of all levels would have this sense that there was a sort of facade of a state. Yeah, there's a finance ministry, there's a central bank, there's a military. But really, power resided behind that. It's generally kind of these coteries around the presidency and the top military guys. And it's something between kind of the Davos world and the Victor Boot world. Somehow these things become fused.
Victor Boot, the arms trader.
Victor Boot, the arms trader, would sit in Eastern Congo in the bars there and hear tales of how Boot used to come in and trade AK-47s for coltan, which would go out and people would make mobile phones from it. Mm. I mean, these networks, these shadow states that, as you say, leave massive amounts of people behind in a big informal economy, they've become detached. And so it's incredibly hard for some of the really brave activists in the Niger Delta or Angola or Zimbabwe to call them to account because they only have national institutions to do that through, if that makes sense.
Well, what makes sense in a chilling way, as I think of sort of the opposite of what you've just said, is every time you take a call on your cell phone or play around on your smartphone, you're essentially waving the flag of these stateless, extreme poverty populations that have no one to go to.
I think so. I think I had to grapple with this a lot, this idea of the extent to which we are all complicit in this. We get in a big fuss if a sweatshop collapses in Bangladesh and we know that they were making our soccer balls or our T-shirts or whatever for a particular company, there would be boycotts, there would be outrage, that company would be under great pressure. Similarly, we're all obsessed with where our coffee comes from and whether it's been bought through some kind of fair trade arrangement and something that's not exploitative. But in this studio, as in any other room in the country, we're surrounded by copper wiring, aluminum. We drove here in cars that were running on often African crude. We proposed to our lovers with diamonds from some of the most troubled parts of Africa. And yet we seem either oblivious to that connection or unwilling to address the notion that these basic material comforts that we enjoy in the rich world are sometimes indirectly but very strongly linked to violence, very low standards of living, and rampant misrule on the other side of the ocean.
Tom Burgess is a reporter for the Financial Times. His new book is The Looting Machine. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you very much.
And here's something to take with you today, because it is National Jelly Bean Day. That's right. That's right. And if that isn't important enough for you, then you can celebrate National Administrative Professionals Day, which has to be an updated euphemism for what was once called Secretary's Day. Sound too boring for you? It's also National Girl Scout Leaders Day, which means every year on April 22nd, we have to choose which is more important, a jelly bean, a secretary, or a Girl Scout leader. Well, thankfully, in 1970, when Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson, after witnessing the ravages of the 1969 oil spill in Santa Barbara, California, announced the idea for a national teach-in on the environment, on the 22nd of April, 20 million Americans took to the streets, parks, and auditoriums to demonstrate for a healthy, sustainable environment in massive coast-to-coast rallies. Today, Earth Day is commemorated in more than 190 countries. It was a gamble, Gaylord Nelson recalled, but it worked. Thanks for listening. More news tomorrow. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.